kiss your lips a thousand times, and more times than I can count. I have called you mine. You have stood by me in my
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We have a lot to share. Starting, of course, with the latest in health and healing, we're going to talk about the childhood psychological abuse epidemic, whether it's physical and sexual or just violent, it all makes an impact. I think you'll find it interesting because it impacts people later in life, of course. Regular consumption of fried food before pregnancy increases the risk of developing diabetes when you're pregnant, and that's an epidemic. Also, the amino acid arginine found to be effective against glucose metabolism in diabetes, as effective as any drug. Well, that's good because there are no negative side effects for that. And we also will be looking at yoga, especially for people who suffer from scoliosis, because it improves the spine curvature. Plus, the Montmorency tart cherry is great for gout, and a lot more on health and healing. Also today, I'm going to quote a Chris Hedges commentary, Ordained to Write. And I found this very moving. He is, without exception, one of our most important progressive thinkers, and he's an activist, and he lives that life. So I'm going to share this, and I'm going to share some music right behind it that I think that you'll enjoy, because people know that now they know that they didn't know before. I appreciate gospel music, and I think the gospel music I'm going to play segues to this particular theme that he's writing. And you don't have to be from any religion, you don't have to have any religious belief to appreciate his message and the music. Also today, I'm going to talk about how's it going for those people, including on Pacifica, who supported the invasion of Libya. Why hasn't anyone called them out on it? So I'm going to talk about all the displaced people and the state of Libya today. Also, a terrible normality, the massacres of history, Michael Parenti from Global Research, and the myth of America from Dar Jamal, who I had on this program last week. Happy Columbus Day. Well, not quite. Not if you look at the truth of history. We'll share that. Oh, and I forgot, half of today's program will be in a debate. The debate will be between George Galloway and Christopher Hitchens. Now, for some of the stations carrying this, this may run a little bit long, maybe 2 or 3 minutes long. So if you can play that, I think people would really appreciate it. If not, people can always go to the archives because it's a half-hour debate. Now, here are two of the most brilliant social critics in contemporary history. And each one makes some very important points. But you got to listen to both discussions full through before you make up your mind about who made the most significant statements and challenges. Let's begin. This is from the Justice Resource Institute, and it says this: children who are emotionally abused and neglected face similar and sometimes worse mental health problems as children who are physically or sexually abused, yet psychological abuse is rarely addressed in prevention programs or in treating victims, according to the American Psychological Association. Quote, given the prevalence of childhood psychological abuse and the severity of harm to young children, it should be at the forefront of mental health and social service training. And that's according to the lead author. So what they're saying in here is that we pay attention to physical abuse and sexual abuse. But we never pay attention to psychological abuse. We have no preventative studies in it. We have no way of helping people. Now, the second part of this is the science of epigenetics, which means that anything that was said to you that you construe as abusive or negative, that hurt your feelings when you were a child, young child, where you really couldn't process something rationally, you process it emotionally. Let's say you had a dominant parent that you could not defy, you could not stand up to. Then while you're standing there, taking on some form of, verbal abuse, and even when the parent may not realize how powerful their words are, the energy by which they're shared, the tone, the eye contact, the body language. If someone is yelling at you and their neck is tense and they've made a fist, all of that your body is perceiving. It's like a radar. You're scanning everything and you're processing it at the DNA level. Literally, it becomes a part of your DNA. That then creates a pattern of fear and insecurity. So now, no one knows this because you have no physical scars, but you have emotional scars. This study is showing that, quote, children who are emotionally abused and neglected face similar and sometimes worse mental health problems as children who are physically or sexually abused. Yet psychological abuse is rarely addressed in preventative programs. I want to emphasize that because I've been looking at statistics of how many children were emotionally abused, emotionally abandoned, where the parent didn't think they were abusing the child, but they were just too busy. I have counseled so many adults who the physical problems they're manifesting, the stress problems, the psychological problems, the intestinal problems, the problems you would never attach to behavior. Once you clear up that behavior, frequently through regressive hypnosis and other more holistic, humanistic psychological approaches, the person is relieved of their physical problems. I'll give you one good example. This is a perfect example and not an unusual example. This is common. A woman is 33 years of age. She has been able to maintain relationships, though she's educated, attractive. She is socially very competent, meaning she knows everything that's going on. So she has no problem attracting people into her life, but she ends up self-sabotaging all the relationships. She says she becomes hypercritical of the man. She looks for anything that in her mind justifies that he was not the right man. And of course, in everyone, you're going to find something that's not right. We're not perfect people. So she says, the harder everyone works to make it work, the more I find ways of sabotaging it. Until one day, nobody wants to be around me because I'm so hypercritical of them. I judge them, and harshly. Now, we know through some psychological work she had with a holistic clinical psychologist that her parents, both professionals, had no real quality time for her. She had nannies raising her, but with the best of intent, she went to private schools, she was groomed, she became a straight-A student, she succeeded at everything she did, and the parents would only be there occasionally, but they were always way too busy with their schedules. And so she was given a form of psychological abuse because she was given neglect. And what we don't pay attention to, what we neglect, loses its balance. It's no different than you had a garden, let it overgrow. You have a car, you never change the oil. We forget that relationships with everyone in our life has to be maintained at a very high level of quality. So now that she has gone through that process, understands it, and has been healed from it, now she has, for the first time, a healthy, sustainable relationship because She's not looking for the wrong things in people. Here's the takeaway message from this. What you're hiding from the rest of the world also hide you from the rest of the world. You cannot present your full self. That dark place in you that you avoid, but that's from with, that's all the marching orders to find something wrong with this person, then nail them. Never make them feel good enough, worthy enough. Make them always feel uncomfortable. Well, you win. You know, in time, the best person in the world is going to say goodbye. March in the direction of your weakest, darkest part of your nature. Next up, regular consumption of fried food before pregnancy increases the risk of gestational diabetes. This is an important study published in the Journal of the European Association for the Study of Diabetes. And what it says is that people who were consuming fried food, that's any form of fried food, you just upped your rate of diabetes substantially. And this was part of the Nurses Health Study, where they looked at 21,000 pregnancies. And there were 116,000 nurses in the study. And they, 25 to 44 years of age, those that had a healthy diet, did not eat the fried food, did not have the diabetes. Those who, quote, ate the French fries, fried chicken, and fried fish, and ate it out, ate it in, you had the diabetes. It's that simple. So if you are pregnant, get off the fried food. There's an amino acid. It's called arginine. Arja, A-R-G-I-I. Nine, N-I-N-E. When you look at the nine at the end, arginine, that's almost always an amino acid. It was effective as drugs. That's the good point. At preventing glucose metabolism and diabetes. By 40% better. Now, where are you going to find arginine? Well, you'll find it in almonds, hazelnuts. You can buy it as a supplement, which is probably the best way, because at least you know how much you're getting. And so when you look at how many people are overweight and how many people have diabetes and how many people are pre-diabetic, well, just by having arginine, you could help yourself. You bet. So make sure you're getting your arginine each day. It's a simple, inexpensive, very healthy amino acid to have. Also, the Montmorency tartare. Most people don't like it because it's tart. Even as a dried fruit, it's tart. But it's really good for you. This is from Northumbria University. Quote, evidence that Montmorency tartare could be useful in managing gouty arthritis and other inflammatory conditions is mounting, as a new study shows that tartare concentrate lowers uric acid and C-reactive proteins, a marker for inflammation. This was published in the Journal of Functional Foods, and it wasn't a lot of your tartare. I would say about a tablespoon a day. Quote, put simply, uric acid crystals in the toes, usually the great toe, cause excruciating pain. If you can lower uric acid, you might also reduce issues associated with gout. And that was from the head of the department who did the study. One little quick thing here. It's not just it lowers pain and gout, but there are hundreds of studies on cherries, especially the tartare. And it's rich in what are called antho, A-N-T-H-O, cyaninins, C-Y-A-N-I-N-S. And these help rejuvenate your DNA. They turn off inflammation. They help in the glucose maintenance process. So they're really good for you. So anytime you can get a separate bottle of tartare concentrate, do so. It'll help you tremendously. And two ancient herbs, been around a long time, help with your total immunity, and especially at a time when you want to be having strong white blood cells or leukocytes. Why? Because that's your front line in defending your immune system. And they're what help grab, target, and envelop invaders, the foreign bodies. Bacterial, viral, doesn't matter what it is. Now, you have a lot of different white blood cells, and you want to keep it in a certain range. And they're created in the bone marrow, the spongy tissue at the center of large bones. And there are five distinct types of white blood cells. The first responders, called the neutrophils, they're the most abundant. In fact, the lower that count is, the more likely you are to get infected. Then they have the white blood cells, the normal white blood cells. And what makes all of these white blood cells work best? Two simple herbs. Cat's claw. Cat's claw is from the Amazon rainforest. It's also found in Central America. And it's derived from its curved claw-shaped looking thorns. It's kind of like a woody vine, resemble a cat's claw. The bark is and the root are what are used traditionally in the native herbalism. It's been around for more than 2,000 years, and it's been shown in hundreds of studies to improve the T cells. It's what I put in every protocol for everyone I counsel with AIDS defining illnesses to help their T count. And also astragalus. Astragalus is a traditional Chinese herb. It's also what is called the qi, and it's producing, meaning in Chinese medicine, the qi, you want to, it's your life energy, and you want a tonic that stimulates qi, and the astragalus is a qi manifesting adaptogenic immunostimulant tonic. It's that simple. So if you want to prevent yourself from having colds and flus, astragalus, and also cat's claw. And finally, from Columbia University, a single yoga pose each day can improve spine curvature for scoliosis patients. Quote, a new study claims performing a single yoga pose for 90 seconds for at least 3 days a week could reduce spine curvature in patients with scoliosis in as little as 3 months. How about that? That was published in the Global Advances in Health and Medicine. I'm sure the people in this audience who know scoliosis is a condition which the spine curves to the side, affects millions and millions of people in the United States, and all age groups are affected, and you really start to see people bent over. So yoga can make a big difference, and I also believe chiropractic adjustment can make a big difference. I'm Gary Nall. Issue of the day. This comes from Middle East Eye. Almost 300,000 people displaced by Libya violence and the UN. Quote, a spike in clashes between rival militias in Libya has pushed the number of people driven from their homes to an estimated 287,000, the United Nations Refugee Agency said on Friday. And keep this in mind. Why did we need, and why did people in Pacifica promote, actively promote, never been held accountable, for the oil-rich North African nation of 6 million people that had the highest standard of living, the highest income per family and person in Africa, where they had free education, free medical care, and if they couldn't be treated in Libya, they were sent anywhere in the world and their entire medical bill was paid and their families' travel expenses and the hotel and rent was paid while they were being treated, plus their medical bills. So if they had to go to the Cleveland Clinic or the Mayo Clinic, all that was paid for. When you were married, you received, I think it was $36,000. And I'm not suggesting that Gaddafi was a nice person. He was not. He was as corrupt and immoral as any other potentate. But now compare Libya then and compare it today. What do we gain? How'd that work out for you? Oh, I forgot. You're the same people who still haven't apologized for our misadventures in Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia. Well, for the rest of the public who have forgotten, Libya is still there. It's still a completely failed state. Now, this is from Chris Hedges. Let me quote it verbatim. And then following this, I'm going to give you I don't have my 2000 collection archives from upstairs, but we had from Gene Bailey. I think this is appropriate to Chris, so it's dedicated to Chris. Oh, and by the way, today I heard from Ellie from the who's the drummer's son, 56 years old, of the Blues Brothers from Fontaine. And he said that as far as he knew, all the Blues Brothers, all of the Funk Brothers have passed. He's looking to see if any are still alive, because I said it'd help him. And also a call out to his female partner, Sherry Foster. She's a CPA. She wrote a book called Not for Women Only. And I said, that's an unusual title. And he said, yeah, well, she read For Women Only, your book, and decided to do it Not for Women Only. It's a book of poetry. And she listened to the show, and they both live a very healthy life. So Eli's son gave me a whole lot of background today that I'll share with you in the upcoming future about what it was like for the people who wrote all the hits for the Four Tops, the Temptations, the Supremes, Marvin Gaye. And his father came over from Marvin Gaye's original band and stayed with him and played on hundreds of songs. And he was the sax player on What's Going On and all those other hits. So if there's any Funk Brother out there, we're looking for you to try to help you live a longer life. And, but that's true of any of the people who are involved in Motown. Now to Chris Hedges. The article's entitled Ordained to Write. 30 years ago, I stood in a church in Albany, New York, with my father, a Presbyterian minister. I graduated from Harvard Divinity School and had purchased a one-way ticket to El Salvador, where the military government, backed by the United States, was slaughtering 700 to 1,000 people a month. I had decided, as George Orwell and James Baldwin did earlier, to use my writing as a weapon. I would stand with the oppressed. I would give them a voice. I would describe their suffering and their hopes. I would name the injustices being done to them. It was a decision that would send me to war for 2 decades to experience the worst of human evil, to taste too much of my own fear, and to confront the reality of violence and random death. But going to El Salvador as a reporter was not something the Presbyterian Church at the time recognized as a valid ministry, and a committee rejected my call. I told my father, who was waiting outside their meeting room, that I was not to be ordained. It must have been hard for him to see his son come so close to ordination, only to have it slip away, and hard to know that his son was leaving for a conflict in which journalists had been killed and would be killed. What the church would not validate, he did. You, he said, are ordained to write. James Baldwin, the son of a preacher, and for a time a preacher himself, said he left the pulpit to preach the gospel. Baldwin saw how the institutional church was often the enemy of mercy and justice. He saw how it too easily devolved into a sanctimonious club whose members glorified themselves at the expense of others. Baldwin, who was gay and black, was not interested in subjugating justice and love to the restrictions imposed by any institution, least all the church. And that is why there is more gospel, true gospel, in Baldwin than in the writings of nearly all the theologians and preachers who were his contemporaries. His essays are sermons, among them Princes and Powers, Down at the Cross, The Devil Finds Work, Sermons and Blues, and History as Nightmare. Baldwin deplored the self-love in American society. He counted white and black Christian churches as being in the vanguard of self-love and denounced what he called the lie they pretended to be through humanism. In his essay, Down at the Cross, he wrote, There was not love in the church. It was a mask for hatred and self-hatred and despair. The transfiguring power of the Holy Ghost ended when the service ended and the salvation stopped at the church door. When we were told to love everyone, I had thought that meant everybody. But no, it applied only to those who believed as we did, and it did not apply to white people at all. He went on, if the concept of God has any validity or any use, it can only be to make us larger, freer, and more loving. If God cannot do this, then it is time we got rid of him. End quote. Baldwin, like Orwell, named truths that few others had the courage to name. He condemned evils that were held up as virtues by the powerful and the pious. And in this, Baldwin was true to a spirit and power beyond his control. He was, in religious language, possessed, and he knew it. Quote, the artists and the revolutionary function as they function and pay whatever dues they must pay behind it because they are both possessed by a vision. And they do not do so, follow this vision, as find themselves driven by it. Otherwise, they could never endure, much less embrace, the lives they are compelled to lead. End quote. This was a sentiment understood by Orwell, who fought against the fascists in the Spanish Civil War and lived with tramps in Paris and London, as well as with impoverished coal miners in the north of England. Quote, my starting point is always feeling a partnership, a sense of injustice. Orwell wrote, when I sit down to write a book, I do not say to myself I'm going to produce a work of art. I write it because there is some lie that I want to expose, some fact to which I want to draw attention, and my initial concern is to get a hearing. Orwell, like Baldwin, disdained the hypocrisy of the institutional church. He acidly observed that pious Christian capitalists do not seem to be perceptually different from other capitalists. Religious beliefs, he wrote, is frequently a psychological device to avoid repentance. Moses, the pet raven in his animal farm, is used to pacify the other animals, telling them they were all going to an animal paradise called Sugar Candy Mountain once their days of labor and suffering come to an end. Quote, as long as supernatural beliefs persist, men can be exploited by cunning priests and oligarchs, and the technical progress, which is the prerequisite of a just society, cannot be achieved. And yet, like Baldwin, Orwell feared this sanctification of state power and the rise of the manufactured idols that took the place of God, those who promised an earthly rather than a heavenly paradise. Orwell struggled throughout his life to find a belief system strong enough to oppose it. Quote, if our civilization does not regenerate itself, it's likely to perish. He wrote shortly before publishing Animal Farm that regeneration, at least in Europe, he said, would have to draw on a moral code based on Christian principles. In The Fire Next Time, Baldwin wrote, quote, life is tragic simply because the earth turns and the sun rises and sets, and one day, for each of us, the sun will go down for the last time, the last time. Perhaps the whole root of our trouble, the human trouble, is that we will sacrifice all the beauty of our lives, we'll imprison ourselves in totems, taboos, crosses, blood sacrifices, steeples, mosques, races, armies, flags, nations, in order to deny the fact of death, which is the only fact we have. It seems to me that one ought to rejoice in the fact of death, ought to decide indeed to earn one's death by confronting with passion the conundrum of life. On Sunday, October 5th, after several years of volunteering as a teacher at the New Jersey prison system, I entered into the formal embrace of the church to continue my work with the incarcerated. But in my own mind, and in the mind of my father, I was ordained long ago. I was possessed by a vision, a call, to tell the truth, which is different from reporting the news, and to stand with those who suffered, from Central America to Gaza, Iraq, to the United States, the vast archipelago of prisons. You're not really a journalist, my friend and fellow reporter Stephen Kinzer once told me. You're a minister pretending to be a journalist. Life is a circle. We return to our origins. We become who we are created to be. In my ordination, at which the radical theologian Reverend James Cone preached and Cornel West spoke, and the Michael Packer Blues Band played, makes that circle complete.
Let me hear the worshipers! Where's all of my praises? I want everybody around the world to put your hands together, because all the praise belongs to God. Here we go. It's who I got. Take it up, every praise. It's to our God. Every word of worship. With one accord. Come on, say every praise. Every praise. It's to our God. I want everybody all over the world to sing hallelujah. To our God. Glory, hallelujah. It's to our God.
Dedicated to James Baldwin and the newly ordained Chris Hedges. Now, let's go to one of the most formidable debates you're ever going to listen to.
I consider it a great distinction to stand on the podium at Baruch College, named for the great Bernard Baruch, who first in 1946 proposed that weapons of mass destruction be placed under international inspection and control. I'm grateful to the audience also for giving me the chance to revisit my misspent Trotskyist days. Dishing out a leaflet in steaming heat on the street outside made me feel and look, I hope, much younger. And we're also, of course, on this side of the house here to share with Mr. Galloway the ambition that his views and his record be much better known than they are. And most of you, I hope, will have the leaflet that details this, and those of you who don't, and those of you who are watching or joining us from other audiences can go to hitchensweb.com and download the whole lot, and I hope they will and share it. An impression, I think, ladies and gentlemen, has been allowed to form and perhaps even to coagulate and to congeal, that it is only those of us who support the regime change the revolutionary change in Iraq who have any explaining to do. I think that that assumption needs to be countered from the very beginning. If you examine the record of the so-called anti-war movement in this country and imagine what would have happened had its counsel been listened to over the last 15 and more years, you would have a world in which the following would be the case. Saddam Hussein would be the owner and occupier of Kuwait. He would have succeeded in the annexation, not merely the invasion, but the abolition of an Arab and Muslim state that was a member of the Arab League and of the United Nations. And with these resources, as we now know, because he lost that war, he was attempting to equip himself with the most terrifying arsenal that it was possible for him to lay his hands on. That's one consequence of anti-war politics. That's what would have happened. In the meanwhile, Slobodan Milosevic would have made Bosnia part of a greater Serbia, and Kosovo would have been ethnically cleansed and also annexed. The Taliban would be still in power in Afghanistan if the anti-war movement had been listened to, and Al-Qaeda would still be their guests. And Saddam Hussein, with his crime family, would still be privately holding ownership over a terrorized people in a state that's been most aptly described as a concentration camp above ground and a mass grave underneath it. Now, if I had that record politically, I would be extremely modest. I wouldn't be demanding explanations from those of us who said it's about time that we stop this continual capitulation to dictatorship, to racism, to aggression, and to totalitarian ideology, that we will not allow to be repeated in Iraq, the failures in Rwanda and in Bosnia and in Afghanistan and elsewhere. And we take pride in having taken that position, and we take pride in our Iraqi and Kurdish friends who are conducting this struggle on our behalves, I should say. What did it mean to accept this responsibility? We knew it was a weighty one, and we knew it was a dangerous one. I will argue that the war was both just and necessary. I think one could separate perhaps the two concepts. Iraq had lost its sovereignty as far as a state can do under international law. There are four conditions under which a state may be deemed or said to have sacrificed its sovereignty. These are: if it participates in regular aggressions against neighboring states or occupations of their territory, if it violates all the letter and spirit of the terms of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and in other words, fools around promiscuously with the illegal acquisition of weapons of mass destruction. Third, if it should violate the Genocide Convention, the signatories to which are obliged, without further notice, to act either to prevent or to punish genocide. And fourth, if it plays host to international gangsters, nihilists, terrorists, and jihadists. Iraq met all these four conditions repeatedly and demonstrated its willingness to repeat them on many occasions. Its sovereignty was at an end. It was under international sanctions. It was a ward of the international community. Its people were being starved in order to build palaces for their psychopathic dictator. And it was furthermore imploding as a state and as a society. The divide and rule policy of the Ba'ath Party had led to appalling ethnic and confessional hatreds within the country. An imploded state would have made these worse, and you know who would have invaded then. Turkey would have invaded to try and take Kurdistan. Iran would have invaded to support its extremist Khomeiniite proxies, and Saudi Arabia would have intervened in order to do the same favor for the Sunni and Wahhabist and Salafist extremists. As a matter of fact, all these three foreign interventions are taking place at present. All those three powers are trying to meddle in Iraq, but we are fortunate, as are the Iraqi people, that there is a coalition to hold the ring and to prevent it from becoming another Rwanda or another Congo, another vortex of violence and cruelty and destabilization and war. And this, I think, again, is a point to take pride in. It was the only responsible course. I'm willing at any point to take questions, and I'm sure I shall be invited to, about my own criticisms of and misgivings about differences with those who conducted and conduct this policy. But on these main points, it seems to me that there's very little room for debate. What are the... thank you. Now, we know, and we make no secret of the extraordinary difficulties that have attended this I think, very noble and risky and worthwhile enterprise. All of you will know, all of you will have seen some of the abysmal consequences of this. But you have, I think, the responsibility of imagining what the alternative would be. I am simply going to say what I think the positive reasons are. Excuse me, the positive consequences are. And I hope someone will be showing me the tie, maybe, just so I don't trespass on my own argument or the patience of the comrades. Who's going to be showing me the tie? You, okay. Will you let me know when I've got 3 minutes, say? Positive results, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters. A man who planned and ordered and supervised and took delight in a genocide and torture and aggression and the occupation of two neighboring states and the massacres of their people is in jail now and will follow Slobodan Milosevic and Augusto Pinochet into the dock quite soon. I know there are some people here who don't take delight in this, but I will say that I do. That it's a long overdue justice. A long overdue act of justice and mercy. A constitution, a federal democratic constitution, is being debated now as we speak with the printing of 5 million copies of a provisional document, debated on 6 television channels, 6, and perhaps as many as 100 newspapers, in a country where 3 years ago it was death, not just for you, but for your family, to possess a satellite dish or to attempt to distribute a leaflet. Death for you and your family, and not a quick one either. Does anyone not agree that this is a night and day difference? I invite them to say if they don't. The largest stateless minority in the Middle East, the people of Kurdistan, in other words, who have suffered many years of oppression and exile and occupation, in Syria, in Iraq, in Iran, and in Lebanon, and in Turkey, have begun to scramble, so to say, to their feet, to assume something like their full height as a people. Even before the intervention, they were producing an autonomy, a democracy, a self-determination of their own in the provinces of northern Iraq, which, when I saw them last, were a landscape of desolation and depravity. You could still smell the poison gas, you could still smell the mass graves, the ruined cities, the burned hillsides, the women who had chemical burns that still burn after years. Out of this, the Kurds have begun to build and help other Iraqis build when they could have been chauvinistic. They could have been xenophobic. They could have said, enough with Iraq. We're through with it. We're leaving. Instead, accepted their internationalist responsibilities. President Talabani, it seems to me, is a president of whom any country in the region could be proud, and not just by the sort of comparisons one could make. This is an extraordinary, unarguable, unambiguous gain. The disarmament of Libya, the capitulation of Colonel Gaddafi, his abandonment of his covert arsenal of weapons of mass destruction, and the walking back of the evidence that he gave us, because we all have it now, thank you, sir, in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, which I think is the right place for it, on analysis was able to disclose to us that the provenance of much of this illegal weaponry was the AQ Khan network in Pakistan, a kind of Walmart for WMD, nukes are us, with a line stretching all the way from North Korea to the Iraqi envoys who in March 2003, as the coalition was preparing to intervene, were negotiating in Damascus with the envoys of Kim Jong-il to buy North Korean missiles off the shelf. And people say Iraq and WMD can't be mentioned in the same breath. Now, not everything about this can be attributed to the intervention, but it's noticeable, I think, that Colonel Gaddafi did not, when he wanted to capitulate, go to Mr. Kofi Annan, for example, or that great statesman, Mr. Jacques Chirac, a man so corrupt, as said of Mr. D'Alembert, I think, in Sentimental Education, so corrupt he would willingly have paid for the pleasure of selling himself. Nor to Gerhard Schroeder, the rump figure of what was once a proud German social democracy. No, he came to Mr. Blair and to Mr. Bush and says, I'm out of this game now, and you can analyze everything I've got. That's not nothing, ladies and gentlemen, and it's a step towards disarmament and non-proliferation into the bargain. And then the spread, no less important, of the democratic impulse within the region. Not only is this being spread by the vector of the Kurdish people and their revolution, because as you will be readily able to find if you haven't read of it already, there have been demonstrations in Qamishli, the Kurdish main city in northern Syria, Among the oppressed Kurds who suffer under the ossified theocracy of Iran, and of course in Turkey as well, to pick up the message that yes, liberation is at hand. These demonstrations broke out on the day that President Talabani was sworn in as President of Iran. There's an unmistakable connection between them. We who have been friends of the Kurds are very proud of their achievement, and we intend to stand by them no matter what. I will add that the moral leader of the Egyptian democracy movement, the man who has begun to break open the argument in Egypt and who suffered a long period of imprisonment during this time and was written to by Nelson Mandela as Egypt's equivalent, has told me, and for quotation, that in his opinion, this new mood in the region would be unthinkable if it was not for the removal of the single worst tyrant who was present there. That's not nothing as in point of testimony. That's from deep within the bowels of the Egyptian prison system, the man who is the moral hero of the democracy movement. He says, and I agree with him, and he's echoed by Anwar Ibrahim as far away as Malaysia, who is the Malay equivalent, and by the leader of the Socialist Party of Lebanon, Mr. Jumblatt, have all stated publicly that this for them is the beginning of the end, the fall of the wall, as they put it. This, I think, is also something to take pride in. Now, I could have said this in front of any audience and against any antagonist, but in my last 2 minutes, I will have to say that I believe it is a disgrace that a member of the British House of Commons should go before the United States Senate subcommittee and not testify, but decline to testify, and to insult all those who try to ask him questions with the most vile and cheap gutter snipe abuse. I think that's a disgrace. And I've got one minute. And it is worse than a disgrace. That's not coming out of my time. If you knew how you looked and sounded, comrades, when you do that. Well, the cameras can take care of it. That's not coming out of my time. It is not just a disgrace, it is a crime that Mr. Gaddafi has profited from the theft of money from the Iraqi Oil for Food program, has told continuous lies about his profiteering from it and the foul associates that he made, at a time when Iraqi children were dying, and $11 billion from this program, $11 billion, went to the murderer and criminal and sadist and fanatic Saddam Hussein. How can anyone who's a business partner of this regime show their face in a city like this and not content with it? Not content with it. Not content with it. He turns up in Damascus. The man's search for a tyrannical fatherland never ends. The Soviet Union's let him down. Albania's gone. The Red Army's out of Afghanistan and Czechoslovakia. The hunt persists. Saddam has been overthrown, and his criminal connections with him have been exposed. But on to the next. On the 30th of July, in Damascus in Syria, appearing, I've given it all to you in a piece of paper, in front of Mr. Assad, whose death squads are cutting down the leaders of democracy in Lebanon, as this is going on, to tell the Syrian people they're fortunate to have such a leader. The slobbering Dauphin, who they got because he's the son of the slobbering tyrant who came before him. How anyone with a tincture of socialist principle can act or speak in this way is beyond me, and I hope, ladies and gentlemen, far beyond you and far beneath your contempt. Thank you.
George Galloway, your response.
Well, Chair, ladies and gentlemen, slobbering was the note that Mr. Hitchens chose to end on. I'm not sure that was wise.
Bring it on.
But I want to begin by praising Mr. Hitchens. In Dundee, my home city, at the annual delegate meeting of the National Union of Journalists, 25 years ago, the same Mr. Hitchens made a speech in which he praised me and the City Council for what he described as its brave act of twinning the city of Dundee with the Palestinian city of Nablus. He said...
No. Must have been someone else.
He said that it was... I didn't interrupt you, so perhaps you'll not slobber over my remarks.
Someone else.
You see, it was very important, Mr. Hitchens' support for the Palestinian people, and it was not easy in 1980. Only a few years before, the Palestinian resistance had seized the Israeli Olympic Games team in Munich and had committed what most people in the world described as an act of mass terrorism. Mr. Hitchens' courageous stand with groups like the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the hijackers of many an aircraft, the carrying out of many a military operation, was very significant because it was very rare. Equally, I want to thank Mr. Hitchens for the brave stand that he made against the war on Iraq in 1991. I want to say, and I've never had the chance to thank him for this, one of the magic moments of that great era was Christopher Hitchens on television with the gun nut Charlton Heston. When Heston was fulminating, desperate to get in there, desperate to attack, Hitchens told him to keep his wig on, and then he asked him, magically, to name four countries with a border with the country he was so keen to invade. And Heston, of course, could name none. That was important because it was very difficult to oppose the war against Iraq in 1991. After all, it was ruled by somebody called Saddam Hussein. It was governed by the Ba'ath Party, who continued to govern it thereafter. It was only 3 years since those chemical weapons that Mr. Hitchens could still smell when he was last there had been launched against the Kurdish people, whom he will never leave alone. Only 3 years before Halabja had taken place. And of course, perhaps most significantly of all, it was difficult to oppose that attack on Iraq in 1991 because Iraq had invaded and abolished, to quote him a few minutes ago, a member state of the Arab League of the United Nations, a Muslim Arab country. Notwithstanding all of these things, Mr. Hitchens bravely, fanatically, you may say, stood against the idea of President George Bush invading Iraq in 1991. What you have witnessed since is something unique in natural history. The first ever metamorphosis from a butterfly back into a slug.
Not bad.
And I mention slug purposefully because the one thing a slug does leave behind it is a trail of slime. Now, I was brought up by my father on the principle never to wrestle with a chimney sweep, because whatever you do, you can't come out clean. But you, Mr. Hitchens, are no chimney sweep. That's not coal dust in which you are covered. You are covered in the stuff you like to smear on to others. Not just me, with your Goebbelian leaflets full of selective quotation, half-truth, mistruth, and downright untruth, and the comments you made in your last 2 minutes of this speech. But people much more gentle than me, people like Cindy Sheehan, described. Whom you described as a sob sister, as a flake, as a Larouche, a woman who gave the life of her son for the war that you have come here to glory in. People like Mr. Hitchens are ready to fight to the last drop of other people's blood, and it's utterly contemptible, utterly and completely contemptible. Now, Hitchens makes much, and I know that he will in his next segment, so I shall, to coin a phrase, preempt it, of the nature and character of those resisting the foreign invasion and occupation in Iraq. I spoke last night in Boston, in a hall where many of the leaders of the great American Revolution stood and spoke. My favorite member of the British Parliament has a statue. It's the first one you meet as you walk in St. Stephen's entry. It is a statue of Charles James Fox. He was expelled twice from Parliament for supporting the American Revolution and supporting the French Revolution. Now, some might say Fox was wrong supporting the anti-colonial struggle of the American people. After all, some might say, better be careful what you wish for, Charlie. Maybe one day that independent free country you're supporting the birth of will be ruled by crazed fundamentalists like Pat Robertson and George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and Michael Ashcroft. They might have said, be careful, Charlie. If this country becomes free, it might one day not even be able to pick up the dead bodies in one of its most important cities a week after they've lain there. Such is the malevolence and incompetence of the government which will rule it. But Fox would have said no. Fox would have said no. He would have said, the American people have a right to be free. Who they choose to rule them is a matter for them. Let them make their mistakes. Let them have their own politics. My country has no right to occupy them any further. Now, I am of Irish background myself. When the Irish people rose in 1916, for their freedom to strike one of the first decisive blows against the British Empire, on which the sun never set because God would never trust the English in the dark. When the Irish people rose, the Hitchens of those days in Bloomsbury, in the salons, denounced the Irish rebels as priest-ridden, bog-trotting, Celtic, Gaelic obscurantists to whom they would never issue from Bloomsbury a certificate of approval. But the only certificate of approval that mattered was the one issued by the Irish people, not the Liberals in London who refused to endorse it. My point is this. For us, in the United States and the United Kingdom, there is only one big question. Mr. Bush actually framed it for us. Are you with the foreign occupation of Iraq, or are you with the right of the Iraqi people to be free and to resist the foreign armies who have violently invaded?
That is, of course, George Galloway debating with Christopher Hitchens. And the full debate, which is nearly an hour, is posted on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com as well as GaryNoll.com, my Facebook. You'll see that as of today. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for taking this extended time to hear it and look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Now let's say hello to Eutrice Leed. Hi, Eutrice.
Hello, Gary. Today we discover a lot of things about the great discoverer of the New World, Christopher Columbus.
right now, Utrecht Slade.
Program director is Jason Taubenfeld. The archive team is Sharon Pride and Casey Holford. And our head engineer is Giselle Hernandez. You can download past programs by visiting our archives at prn.fm.